Today, the chilling reality of Mexico's drug war. And Luke Harding asks why won't the government publish an intelligence report on Russian meddling in British politics? I'd like to start with a warning. This episode contains some scenes of violence from the very start. Tijuana in Mexico, just south of the border with the US, is by some measures the most dangerous place on earth. Last year, there were a record 2,518 murders in a city with a population of less than 2 million. That's a murder rate 90 times higher than London, and this year looks on course to break records again. To try to figure out exactly what is happening, The Guardian's Tom Phillips spent a week with a Red Cross ambulance crew in the city.
Pretty quickly you start seeing victims of shootings, because there are just so many shootings every single day. So on our second night with the Red Cross, we rushed east across town to actually a fairly nice neighbourhood, and we went down this alley to the bottom of a sort of shadowy staircase, and at the bottom of that staircase there was a guy who had been shot at least four times in both wrists and both of his legs, surrounded by police. You know, one of the policemen was pointing a mobile phone in his face to try and get his picture. They were reading his details down the phone back to their base to try and work out who he was. And meanwhile, the Red Cross first responders are strapping him to a stretcher with silver tape and then moving him into the ambulance, and he's in a terrible state.
Did you find out what had happened to him?
No, it wasn't clear. And I think it's often not clear at all what has happened to these guys. You find them full of lead, bleeding, very confused. Generally, they don't have any relatives with them or anyone really who can explain what's going on, and they're in too much of a daze to tell you. So, yeah, it's really disturbing and depressing.
Tom's reporting may have begun in an ambulance tearing around Tijuana, but it took him far beyond the city, deep into Mexico's borderlands, in a region dominated by organised crime, and where the government appears to be losing control. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the cost of Mexico's war with the drug cartels.
It sounds like a war zone. What's going on in Tijuana?
Ultimately, it boils down to drugs, the failed and failing war on drugs, drugs moving north into the US, guns coming south from the US into Mexico. And more recently, it's because of a big crystal meth epidemic that is gripping Tijuana and other Mexican cities. When the new president came to power last December, he promised he would pacify the country. Last year, Mexico registered a record number of murders. It was more than 33,000 in the year. That was up to 25,000 the year before. This year, we've already had 26,000 murders nationwide. So we're on track for a new record this year. And I've been here for just over a year, and it's increasingly clear to me, and more so after this trip and after the events of recent weeks, that there are big areas of this country that are not under the control of the state. First of all, you had 13 police officers killed in an ambush in Michoacán. The following day, you had 15 people, armed men, apparently killed in a shootout in Guerrero State. And then you had one of Mexico's most important cities, Culiacán, brought to a complete standstill as gunmen from one of the country's biggest cartels poured out onto the streets to try and free the son of one of the world's biggest drug lords, El Chapo. And it was a huge humiliation for the Mexican government. The images were stunning. I mean, you had images that looked like they had come from Syria, with these huge columns of smoke pouring up into the sky, men with assault rifles pouring out onto the streets. There were some images of some members of the army who had apparently been kidnapped by the gunmen. So the situation is not under control, and AMLO, López Obrador, Mexico's new president, is under real pressure to find some sort of strategy. The place where you really get a sense of just how bad things are in Tijuana is when you go to the city's morgue, Cemefo. We went there one afternoon and we ended up meeting a woman who didn't want her name to be used in the article because people are afraid to talk about this kind of thing there. But she lives opposite the morgue and has been campaigning to get it moved because there are so many bodies being brought there that it is simply stopped functioning. It's completely over capacity. Pictures we saw showed dozens of bodies splayed out on the floor. They haven't got enough space to keep the corpses that are coming in. She said to us that, you know, it's horrible. Every day we are breathing death. And she said it was okay. We were there in the afternoon and it was a pretty hot day and you could smell it. It was horrible.
Oh my God.
Grim, really, really grim. But in a way, the relatives who we saw turning up at the morgue to try and identify or to reclaim the bodies of their loved ones are the lucky ones, because there are many, many thousands of people in Mexico who are not even able to track down the bodies of their loved ones. People whose brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and children and nephews have simply disappeared off the map.
Do you know how many?
So there are estimated to be something like 40,000 missing people in Mexico. Some of them are thought to have been dissolved in acid, others buried on wastelands, others simply dumped in the desert. And as we were reporting on Tijuana, I heard about an activist organisation that had sprung up in recent years and whose job it was to go out and look for the remains of these people. That group is run by a guy called Fernando Osegueda, and he lost his son in 2007 and has been looking for him ever since. Fernando hasn't yet found his son, but over the years he started helping other families track down the bodies of their loved ones, and so far has reunited families with more than 120 bodies. He invited us to go out with him and a search group in a sort of rural area near a town about 50 kilometres east of Tijuana. So one morning we got up very early and we met him and the others at a motel in Tijuana, and we drove off into the scrublands in the desert near the US border with a forensic team, a Belgian Shepherd dog called Max, who's part of the team, who's used in the searches, the federal police escort, because these areas are very, very dangerous and controlled by organised crime and by the cartels. And we were there to look for a member of a Mexican-American family, a guy called Jose Barajas, who had been dragged from his ranch in early April and had not been seen since.
So he was Jose, right?
Yeah.
And what's your name?
Jose.
Ah, nice, yeah. Junior, yeah.
So we went out that day. Two of the guys who we met and who we were going to go on the search with were Jose's oldest brother, Jesse, and Jose's 28-year-old son, who's also called Jose. So Jose was a local businessman from a big Mexican family. He was not the sort of the life and soul of the party. He kept himself to himself. He wasn't a man who had loads and loads of friends, but he had a really great mind and he really cared a lot about his country.
Yeah, he always liked it here.
He's like it.
Yeah, he always wanted to help out the people, give them jobs, make jobs for the people.
And he employed quite a lot of local people here.
Yeah, he helped out a lot of people.
The area where Jose lived is just south of the US border and is really notorious for the smuggling of fuel, for the smuggling of people, and for the smuggling of drugs. We don't know exactly what happened, but in an area like that, it really doesn't take much to get you on the wrong side of the cartel. One afternoon, we believe, in early April, a group of armed men appeared at his ranch. Jose's brother Jesse told me that the family and Jose had been getting increasingly worried about his security there, and that he'd bought a gun recently. He would almost certainly have tried to fight back, but seems to have come out worse off.
He will not let anybody take him without a fight.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's the kind of person he was.
I know.
Yeah. You can see the marks where he was dragged from the front of the house to the front gate, and then where they threw his body over the fence because there was blood on the fence.
Threw it over the fence.
Yeah, over the block wall. Oh.
To do, just to take it away, or to...
Just to take them away, yeah. And then the marks where the whatever vehicle was parked right there, and you could see where what direction it took off in.
And that's all you know then, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, that's it. Now we're here looking. Yeah. And we're out here because there's people who see the truck leave in this direction.
I see.
Listo, muchachos. Vámonos.
The direction that the truck had gone in when it left the ranch was pretty much the only thing these guys had to go on. So we moved to the east of the ranch, headed into the scrublands on the border, and we formed a human chain and started making our way slowly through this area. It's a vast area of cactuses and tumbleweed, trying to find Jose's body.
What was it like searching?
It's a very odd experience. I've never done anything like that before. You're in a really isolated area. Many of the members of the search group have whistles around their necks. They had green fluorescent whistles to attract the others' attention if they found something. And they also carry these really strange tools, sort of T-shaped metal rods. And they use those. When they find a piece of ground that seems unusually soft or is a strange colour or potentially suspicious, they slide that rod into the earth and then they pull it up and they sniff the tip of the metal rod. And what they're doing is they're trying to open up the ground and they're trying to see if they can smell the scent of decomposing bodies. So you have this large group of people moving through the scrubland, constantly stopping and looking under bushes and heaps of branches, and then putting these sticks into the ground and then raising it to their nose. I mean, it's very strange and really, really appalling when you know that many of those people are family members of Jose, and what they're sniffing for is potentially his remains.
How did you feel?
I felt really, it's really very troubling. It's really disorientating too, because so we're starting this search at about 11 o'clock in the morning. The sun is right up there in the sky. It's scorching hot. There's no shade. As a constant backdrop, you also have the knowledge that you're in an area that is not under the control of the Mexican state, and that is narco territory. And so as Jesse and I move forward, getting actually quite lost and quite disorientated because there are no real reference points and it's quite hard to tell what north, east, south and west, you know, which direction you're moving in. It's really hot, you're getting dehydrated. And then we start to see these vehicles coming back and forth on the nearest road to us, which is a pretty isolated country lane, and seeing these SUVs racing past. And Jesse and the federal policeman, we were with a federal police guard who had an assault rifle around his shoulders, started getting pretty edgy because they thought these guys were what they call halcones, lookouts, who worked for whichever organised crime group it is that controls the area, and obviously wanted to know what the hell a group of federal police and people with metal rods and binoculars and whistles were doing trekking through their turf. And it got pretty frightening, actually.
It's a little bit scary, no?
Huh?
It's a little bit scary, no?
What did you think they were going to do?
The criminal organisations are obviously in such complete control that they do as they will, and they have huge resources. And they are the law. So, I mean, what did I think they might do? Well, you know, we knew that 5 months before they'd come, picked up Jose, whose brother I was with, and taken him off. So, I mean, you can imagine, I guess, what we feared might happen.
What happened next?
So the cars were constantly coming past and we were getting more and more nervous. And Jesse served in the US military and is a pretty tough guy, certainly a much tougher guy than I am. And the federal policeman is obviously armed and trained. And so when I'm watching these guys getting nervous, I'm getting nervous. So we called for backup, and a few minutes later, a police vehicle arrives with six armed men in a pickup truck, and they pull up on the road below us. We come down from the sort of ridge that we're on, and I sort of come crawling out from behind the rock behind which I rather pathetically tried to hide myself. And we come down onto the road, and I saw coming at us down the road on the horizon two very swanky SUVs. And then I noticed that Jesse had noticed it, and the police had noticed it, and the two police on the back of the truck jumped down onto the road. The photographer later told me, who was inside the car, that the police driver of the vehicle, he heard him say something like, "No, no, 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 no," as he looks through the rearview mirror at these guys coming at us. And I shoved my mobile phone back into my pocket and stopped recording or taking pictures, because I'm really not sure what is about to happen. And the cars weren't stopping. And we have two armed policemen now down on the ground, raising their guns towards these cars, and they're still coming, and they're still coming. And I think for me, and I think for probably most people in that vehicle, it was one of those moments where you think, certainly as a journalist, and I don't think that happens very often, fortunately, you think, okay, we shouldn't be here. You know, what a shame we didn't come on another day, because this is probably it. And
you thought that?
Yeah, I think we all thought that. No, it was terrifying. And then the vehicles got very close to us, stopped, and then two men get out of the vehicle and strangely show a document, some sort of document, I don't know what was written on it, to the police who were with us. And they exchange a few words, and I couldn't hear what was said. And then they move back towards their vehicle, and the second vehicle just comes at speed, you know, really starts going for it, puts his foot down and cruises past us very, very quickly. And the windows are up and we never see who's inside, you know, and then we all breathe a very deep sigh of relief. I said, you know, what the bloody hell was that all about? And what I was told was that the second car was carrying quote unquote local investors, you know, and they were just doing business in the region, which struck me, and I think struck everybody else, as completely unconvincing. And, you know, at least my reading of what had happened, and I think it was one that everyone else shared, although we couldn't prove it, was that there was some very big criminal fish. And that very intelligently, I guess, the police we were with had decided that it wasn't worth getting into a fight with those guys because we would lose, and just let them through.
It sounds like there's so little chance of finding anything, that it's incredibly difficult what they're trying to do, that it's potentially really, really dangerous. Why do the families do this? Why are Jose Jr. and Jesse and the rest of the family putting themselves through this level of danger? Do they expect to find a body?
I think part of the answer is that they want answers. They want to know what happened to him. But I think, and I think this speaks to why actually this story for me was one of the most moving and actually quite beautiful stories I can remember reporting, despite, you know, the total grimness of going out with families and looking for dead bodies, right? Is that the answer to that question is actually love. So I said to Jesse, his brother, I said, you know, why are you guys doing this? And he said, you know, when you have feelings about someone, you go beyond. And then I sat down with Jose's son, Jose, and I said to him, I asked the same question, why are you here? I mean, this is so dangerous. And they said it's because they love him and they want to give him a burial and to give him that dignity.
Yeah. It just sucks not knowing where he's at, or I guess we have to be okay with not being okay, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course it does. Yeah. I mean, no one would be able to hold it against you guys
if
you've thought it was too dangerous to be here, or if you felt too, you know, I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah, all we want to do is just give them a proper burial, like every human.
What did you do then? Did you leave them?
So we spent a few more hours looking in the desert, and we didn't find anything apart from a few skeletons, I guess, belonging to coyotes or cows, the animals that had obviously died in the desert. And we called it a day. And then a couple of days later, we met the family again in a city called Ensenada, which is a couple of hours south of Tijuana. This time, that wasn't Jose they were looking for. In Ensenada, we met with a really big group of mostly women who were part of another local association in this town, a seaside town. And we were looking for their relatives. And so Jesse and Jose, and also, in fact, Jose's wife had come to help all these mothers and sisters and brothers and aunts to try and find their loved ones in a completely different part of the state.
So all these families of the missing come together to help each other?
Exactly, and that's why Jose's family had gone there, not really because they thought there was any chance of finding him there, but because they have now become part of a really, in many ways, wonderful and really beautiful movement of people who have lost their relatives and have come together to try and help each other and show solidarity and to try and help others who are in the same situation.
So heartbreaking, Tom. I mean, I'm just thinking of all those women, all of the mothers. They must be in total limbo, unable to properly grieve or say goodbye, but knowing there's so little hope.
It's so heartbreaking. And yet, strangely, at the same time, it's so uplifting and so very moving to see these people joking with each other, you know, forming new friendships, helping each other. Yeah, messing around, you know, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, on one level, it would be just an awful, desperate experience, you know, when you describe it, just moving through these wastelands and rubbish dumps and junk yards that we visited looking for corpses, right? Places, in some places where people have been tortured and, you know, rubbish dumps that stink and it's just disgusting. And then on another level, it's wonderful to see, it's really life-affirming to see these people just, you know, doing what they can and helping each other. No, really, really humbling and moving to see them do that.
Tom, you've told me about these two horrible stories of murder going on in Tijuana and in the countryside around it. And in a way, they're different. In the city, there's this loud, brutal sort of chaos. And in the desert, a quieter kind of grim eeriness. But they both seem to be the consequences of a complete absence of any adequate response from the state, which, as you said earlier, has just lost control. You described a sense of complete lawlessness. And what strikes me is just how impossible this seems to overcome, how huge a task it must be for Mexico to deal with this. Is there any hope of it improving?
I think you're right. I mean, I think it is a huge, huge task. You know, you're talking about a vast country. It's a country that's about eight times as big as the UK. You're talking about a country that has a 3,000 kilometre border with the world's biggest gun market, a country which has tens or hundreds of thousands of weapons pouring across that border every year. You're talking about a country, large parts of which are dominated by drug cartels, and which is also home to a real mosaic of self-defence groups that are also heavily armed. It would be a really huge task for whichever politician was in charge. And, you know, they've been trying to get to grips with this ever since the war on drugs began in 2006. And clearly they have failed. You now have a new leftist president whose doctrine he describes as one of abrazos y no balazos, hugs and not bullets. And he wants to tackle the social roots of crime. He wants to invest in Mexico's youth so that he sort of deprives the cartels of their workforce and stops kids getting dragged into drugs and crime. He's created a 60,000 strong National Guard that he thinks is going to really help cut crime, but so far that seems to have been mostly used to pursue Central American migrants who Donald Trump doesn't want going across the border. So I think whilst most people see the new president's policies and ideas on cutting crime as being admirable in the long term, of course you need to look at the social roots of crime, of course you need to address that. People are worried and people are wondering what he is going to do in the short term to deal with this. And I don't think there's a clear answer to that at the moment. And I think that's a very troubling reality for Mexico in 2019.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thanks, Anushka.
That was Tom Phillips, who has, with colleagues, travelled across Mexico to look at the crisis facing the country. They've written a series of fascinating pieces out this week. Do read them on the website. Coming up, when it comes to an intelligence report on Russian meddling in British politics, what has the government got to hide? Now, the House of Commons Intelligence and Security Committee has produced a 50-page dossier examining Russian infiltration into British politics. But instead of being published, it is sitting in Downing Street. The committee's chairman, Dominic Grieve, called the decision not to release it jaw-dropping, while others have complained of suppression. The Guardian's foreign correspondent, Luke Harding, thinks something fishy is going on.
So the Intelligence and Security Committee have been taking evidence through last year from experts, from spooks, from Christopher Steele, former MI6 officer who wrote the famous report into Donald Trump and Russia. And they essentially have been trying to give a picture of what Russia has been doing around British politics in recent years, including during the 2016 Brexit vote and, of course, the 2017 general election. The report was due out last week. I spoke to one person who gave evidence who said they got an email on Wednesday night saying it's imminent. And then something very mysterious happened. The report went to Downing Street for a sign-off from Boris Johnson, and it didn't emerge, and we haven't seen it. And the longer we don't see it, the more parliamentarians, members of the House of Lords, ordinary voters are beginning to wonder whether something strange is going on. Downing Street said this is all about process, but my understanding is that the security agencies signed off on this long ago, and you have to be suspicious. I think everyone is now suspicious that there are political reasons why this report hasn't come out and that there is embarrassing matter in there. The government says it hasn't seen any signs of successful interference from Moscow, but it hasn't defined what successful means. And what we do know is, like in America, that there was a massive troll operation out of St. Petersburg in favour of Brexit, with Russian state media, a Sputnik RT running pro-leave stories. And also that there was a kind of really a big kind of outreach campaign to the Leave campaign to Aaron Banks, who met with the Russian ambassador on at least three occasions. There's also anxiety about Russian money flowing into the Conservative Party in particular and Russian-linked émigrés, let's put it like that, who have legally donated money to the Conservative Party. And my understanding is that's also something this report covers. One last intriguing footnote about this story is Dominic Cummings. Now, he's the Prime Minister's controversial special advisor, the man behind the successful Brexit campaign. Now, he lived in Russia in the 1990s through 94 and 97. He speaks Russian. He likes Dostoevsky. That's okay. I like Dostoevsky too. But there are concerns, or at least questions, about his Russian connections raised by Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, who says that a whistleblower has come forward saying that they are worried about Dominic Cummings' security clearance, about the vetting that he got when he entered Downing Street. And I'd be very interested to see where Thornberry's letter, which went to Downing Street and to MI5 and MI6, where that goes. I think it's significant because of the timing. We're a few weeks away from a hugely consequential general election, and we are now holding elections in a time of massive anonymous online influence, of dark money, of dark data. And when actually what happened in 2016 around the Brexit referendum has not, to my mind, been kind of properly interrogated. Can someone please leak me this report in a brown envelope to The Guardian, first class stamp? I think it should come out. I think we should read it. And I think someone should send it to me.
That was Luke Harding. My thanks to him and to Tom Phillips. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.